Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, in most parts of the world, inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. It's what some call the Great Convergence. Then, how do our experiences, our traumas, diets, and lifestyles get coded in our genetic systems, then passed on to our offspring and their offspring? And how do they affect our health and our politics? The world is witnessing what our next guest calls a Great Convergence. That is, that inequality is shrinking and the middle class is growing. Joining us in studio is Kishore Mahbubani. He is the dean of the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy at the National University of Singapore and the former ambassador to the United Nations for Singapore. His book is called The Great Convergence: Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Kishore Mahbubani, it's great to have you here with us. Let's start with your basic concept that what we're seeing is this convergence of almost like a global society. You think that's a really good thing. For example, economically, we're seeing far less poverty. What are the numbers? How's it manifested?
Well, I think one of the best kept secrets in the world is that the last 20 or 30 years have been among the best 20 or 30 years for the vast majority of the world's population because their lives are improving on so many counts. Firstly, wars are becoming a sunset industry. In the 1950s, 500,000 people a year would die from wars. Now it's less than 30,000. That's a dramatic decrease. Secondly, global poverty is disappearing. One of the few Millennium Development Goals that we will meet is the halving of global poverty by 2015. And the U.S. National Intelligence Council, a relatively conservative body, has predicted that global poverty will be eliminated completely by 2030.
How are they defining global poverty?
The United Nations has a technical definition. I'm not sure whether it's a dollar or $1.25 a day.
So it's still kind of a low figure.
Yeah, but that's amazing. Hundreds of millions of people have been liberated from absolute poverty. But thirdly, and this is the most stunning thing, the number of people joining middle classes in the world is exploding. And just to take Asia alone, right now, the number of people who enjoy middle class living standards in Asia are roughly about 500 million people, which is a large number, you know, still bigger than the population of the United States of America. But that number in 7 years, by 2020, is going to explode to 1.75 billion, an increase of 3.5 times in 7 years. This is a massive upliftment of humanity that we've never experienced before, and that's why I call it the Great Convergence.
A couple of numbers from your book. There are still 2.5 billion people out of 7 who don't have access to even a toilet, and even more who are without clean cooking facilities. Mm. So we do still have a very large chunk of people who don't have the fundamental basics.
By the way, when I grew up as a child in Singapore, we didn't have a flush toilet in our house. The per capita income was the same as Ghana, and I was put in a special feeding program when I was young. Now, I mention that because Singapore was a typical third world state. Now, Singapore's per capita income is higher than that of the United Kingdom. And we're doing much better than UK in many ways. So the fact that Singapore could go from a typical third world developing country to becoming a modern first world developed country in my lifetime is amazing. But now that feat is being repeated many times over, all over Asia.
There's some other sections of your book, when you put them together, bring up a paradox. And that is the more people that we bring into the middle class, and having 7 billion people on the planet, the more we have a sustainability problem. Can the planet Earth sustain 7 billion people who have all of the comforts of middle class? How do we deal with this?
Clearly, that's a huge challenge. And I think we have to think about it now because, you know, more and more people in the world will want to have electricity in their homes, television sets, cars. And so clearly energy consumption will go up, global greenhouse gas emissions will go up, and we need to do something about it. But the only way to do something about it is to find an equitable mathematical formula. And as the Prime Minister of India says, and I think I quote him in my book, he says, you can't expect me to deprive 400 million Indians of electricity just so that Americans can keep on driving their SUVs. So come on, if America is the richest country, doesn't take the lead in promoting the notion of sacrifice, how can you expect the poorer countries to make a sacrifice? And that's exactly why Copenhagen broke down some years ago, because sadly, President Obama was calling on the poorer countries to make a compromise, but the United States Congress had tied his hands and refused to give him any room for negotiation.
There are voices in the American public sphere that argue the exact opposite. And it's part of what you talk about in this book, The Great Convergence, where we are all thinking about our own state issues and not thinking as a global community. And you point out that three former heads of state have addressed this issue and talked about the global community and how we need to look at these things as a planet, not as individual states. Mm. And yet while they're heads of state, they can't do it.
Yes. In fact, I begin the book with a very simple metaphor to explain how the world has changed. I say that before, when 7 billion people lived in 193 separate countries, it was like they were living in 193 separate boats with captains and crews taking care of each boat and rules to make sure the boats didn't collide. That was the pre-globalization world. But today, with the world having shrunk, the 7 billion people no longer live in 193 separate boats. They live in 193 separate cabins on the same boat. But you have captains and crews taking care of each cabin, but no captain or crew taking care of the global boat as a whole. And that explains all the problems we are having in terms of global financial crisis, in terms of global warming, in terms of pandemics and global terrorism and so on and so forth. So that's why I quote Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Al Gore, all of whom said, hey, we're now living on the same boat. We must now come together. But as you mentioned earlier, the paradox is that what seems so obvious to them, after they left office, they couldn't say while they were in office. And that's the tragedy of democratic politics.
Now, part of your argument is what we're missing is a one world theory, really a theory that leaders can sell to their electorate that would allow them to then participate in these global agreements. What might one look like?
The good news for us is that the world as a whole is becoming a better and better place. More peaceful, less poverty, more prosperous. So the global trends are going in the right direction. So it makes it easier for us to come together and cooperate. Now, frankly, China and India have actually announced they're prepared to make some sacrifices in their development to prevent global warming. Now, that's a remarkable concession from relatively poor countries. So if you can get the richer countries to do the same, and to be fair, the Europeans are doing it. It's only the United States of America where it is impossible politically for the U.S. Congress to make any kind of concessions to reduce global warming. That's why the heart of the problem lies here in the United States.
It's also another paradox. You wrote about this in your book, The Great Convergence, where here, the United States has been the home of a very robust environmental movement. And yet here it is China that is acknowledging climate change and prepared to do something about it. How do we explain this?
You're right. This is a major paradox. And I say somewhat mischievously in the book that perhaps Al Gore, as a symbolic gesture, should announce that he has to return the Nobel Peace Prize because he has failed in his mission of trying to persuade the American public and the American government to make sacrifices to take care of global warming.
You said that China is also developing a vast NGO network that has never been in existence before, and many of these are environmental organizations. What is the impact of this? And is this something that has arisen from the Great Convergence?
China has gone through many dramatic transformations. I mean, when I went to China for the first time in 1980, China was a completely regimented society. There were no skyscrapers in the cities, no billboards, no cars. People were just driving bicycles and people wore Maoist suits. It went from a very tightly regimented society in 1980 to a society that when you go down there looks as open as America in many ways. When you go to the universities, you can discuss anything you want. And amazingly enough, you have various NGOs that have come up that are now quite critical of many of the government's policies. And in fact, the one new political reality that the Chinese Communist Party has to deal with is NGOs who are watching their policies and saying, hey, you're destroying the environment. We have to do something about it.
Another aspect that you mentioned was that a media is starting to develop that is challenging the government at various times. The example you gave in the book was a train crash. In the past, the government might have been able to push it under the covers, but that didn't occur. What happened?
Well, I think in this major train crash, the government tried to go back to its old impulses, which is to pretend that no major disaster had happened. And they almost literally, not metaphorically, tried to bury the evidence. And there was a huge outcry, public outcry, and the government had to stop doing so. Remember, many years, many decades ago, when China had a major earthquake, when Chairman Mao Zedong announced there would be no publicity about the earthquake, the government had to comply. So an entire earthquake was not reported in China. Today, when one train gets involved in a crash, the whole country gets to know about it. That's how China has opened up.
Now, is this also a result of the great convergence you write about because of the technological advances that are occurring?
Yes. In fact, the number one language that is used on the internet today is not English, but is Mandarin, because there are more Chinese internet websites than there are English-speaking websites. So it has become, in that sense, a much more open society. I must emphasize, the government does try to block information flows, cut information flows, but it's very difficult in the world of today.
It seems that this global community that's starting to emerge, as opposed to disparate groups, disparate states, is primarily a result of information and the technology, peer-to-peer media, as well as international media that are allowing people to learn about each other and about different societies and call together perhaps the most eclectic best practices.
In my previous book, The New Asian Hemisphere, I tried to explain why the Asian societies, which have been dormant for two centuries or so, why have they suddenly sprung back to life? And I say the reason why they did so is that they were finally understood, absorbed, and are implementing pillars of Western wisdom, including mastery of science and technology, a culture of pragmatism, meritocracy, a culture of peace, rule of law, and of course, education. But in this new book, I push the argument a bit further. And I say there's a new consensual cluster of norms are emerging in the world, and that results in these countries succeeding and developing. And one of them, for example, is the spread of reason and logic. Governments today, in most places, are beginning to understand how to develop societies. And to give you a simple example, like encouraging people to wash their hands improves hygiene dramatically. And guess what? It leads to less babies dying. So it's simple best practices that are now spreading all over the world and are saving millions of lives.
Is there also a downside? I wonder about the spreading of norms that might not be so productive, the spreading of corrupt practices, for example. Mm-hmm. And this ties back into the idea that in some places we're seeing, as you've noted, that the very poor people are rising and joining the middle class. Whereas in other places like the U.S., the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, and corruption in some cases being rewarded or at least forgiven in very public ways.
Yeah. I must emphasize that I don't claim that the world has reached nirvana yet. I mean, global poverty will not be eliminated in the next 2-3 years. It will be eliminated by 2030. But to look at the world through the eyes of the majority of the world's population, especially the 88% of the world's population that lives outside the West. Now, the population who live in the West have had a bad decade. Since 2008, 2009 financial crisis, things have been very difficult in Europe, things have been very difficult in America. But from the point of view of the majority of the world's population, the 3.5 billion who live in Asia, a billion who live in Africa, the 500 over million who live in Latin America, the last two decades have been wonderful. Six of the 10 fastest growing economies in the past decade have come from Africa. There have been dramatic improvements. Just to give you one statistic, in 1990, there were zero cell phones in India. Zero. But by 2012, that number had grown to 750 million in 2 decades. Now that's a remarkable achievement. And a cell phone, by the way, is not just something that is used for bilateral conversations. It also connects people to the modern world, gives them access to information that they couldn't have before. All these little things have improved their lives dramatically.
You noted Africa. It seems when you look at it through the eyes of mass media that Africa is actually suffering quite a bit, particularly with all of the political violence. Can we really say that things are better in Africa?
Well, if you ask the Africans, they will tell you that things are getting much better in Africa. Our views on the world are conditioned by what we see on television. So we see the violence in Syria, we see the violence in Mali, we see the problems in Sudan, we say, oh, the world is falling apart. But statistically, the number of people who are experiencing violence, especially interstate conflict, is the lowest it has ever been.
Do you think that the emphasis from the statistics is that it's interstate conflict, meaning state versus state, versus the internal conflict? The internal conflict seemed pretty awful.
Most people believe that while people dying from interstate conflict is going down, people dying from intrastate conflicts are going up. And that's not true either. Again, the data is very clear. Of course, there are some countries where conflicts carry on. I mean, this is a fact. Afghanistan is clearly still at war. Somalia still has conflict. Of course, there are problem cases. But, you know, you don't judge the health of a population at large by looking at the people with the worst health. You look at the average throughout the society and the average levels of violence in every dimension, interstate, intrastate, and even domestic violence is going down.
You mentioned also that education is on the rise in these parts of the world.
One of the best things that's happening in the world today is the spread of modern education. And as you know, that's also liberating women. Some of the most stunning statistics I provide come from Iran, where 65% of undergraduate enrollment in Iran is by women in the science area. So much so that the Iranian government had to cut down the number of females going to universities because they were shocked at the number going up. So you can see all over the world, education is spreading. And in look at China, as recently as 1993, only 5% of each cohort went to university. Now that number has grown to 23%. Again, that's in 20 years. The world at large is becoming better and better educated. And that's one of the reasons why the world is becoming more peaceful. That's also another reason why the world is becoming more healthy.
Now, do you see in this convergence that while the rest of the world is coming up, that the United States might be dipping?
Both the United States and EU, as you know, are going through a rough time. The developed world, even if you slide backwards, your quality of life is still much better than that of most people in the developing world. Now, America has got some unique problems now. One of them clearly is rising inequality. That's a challenge it has to deal with. The other challenge, which has come as a shock to the whole world, is the political paralysis in America. And when you watch the debate over sequestration, the incapacity to bust budgets, believe me, this has really shocked the rest of the world. Because in the past, they assume that if they wanted to look for a role model of a democracy that they should copy and emulate, they assumed that America had the best democracy in the world. Today, watching what is going on down here, I can tell you very few countries want to copy American democracy. Their view is something has gone wrong here. We must make sure we do not do what Americans are doing.
I want to go back to a couple of things. One is, again, the information technology, and the other is the issue of the spreading of ethics. I think they fit together. You talked about that one of the important norms was the rule of law. Most people would agree that the rule of law is a very important thing, except for, of course, when the rule of law is very unjust, which we have seen periodically throughout societies, particularly in discriminatory societies, or when they support things like slavery or discrimination.
What I mean by the rule of law, see, Americans take it for granted. I mean, America has one of the best rule of law conditions of any society anywhere in the world, frankly. But the rest of the world has got a long way to catch up in this area. But the good news is that they are moving in the right direction. Because in the past, especially if you live, let's say, in the Arab world, you took it for granted that the rulers had a right to rule and you had to be governed and accept their rules. But as you know, the Arab Spring demonstrated that four rulers who have been ruling for over 150 years, Mubarak, Ben Ali, Gaddafi, the president of Yemen, suddenly disappeared within a year. Why? Because people no longer accept rule by law. They want rule of law. The difference between rule by law and rule by law means the ruler decides and you obey. Rule of law means that there are laws in which not just the people have to comply with, but the rulers have to comply with, which is why Mubarak is in jail. So he too now has to comply with the rule of law. And that's a dramatic revolution. And by the way, this is something that China hasn't achieved yet. Because in China, you still have, in many cases, rule by law, because the Chinese Communist Party still remains above the rule of law. And that's going to be China's biggest challenge. The Chinese Communist Party also have it comply with the same rule of law as the people. And that will take a decade or two, but that's something they have to do.
Where else do you see that as a problem?
If you take a country like Indonesia, which, by the way, is a large country, 240 million people, the fourth most populous country. For a long time, when President Suharto was running it, you had ruled by law. He and his family were above the law. But today, the president of Indonesia is not above the law. There's a free media, there's an independent courts, and very powerful people, including the chairman of the ruling party of the president, and now have to go to court to defend themselves. These are remarkable developments. And even in Pakistan, which, as you know, people believe might become a failed state, the Chief Justice could sack a president. Now, that's a remarkable step forward.
The other paradox that you also point out is while the U.S. has this rule of law domestically, we have problems with the rule of law internationally. And, of course, again, the book being called The Great Convergence, thinking in terms of a global society rather than as individual disparate states. How does that fare with what's happening as a global society?
The tragedy here is that the United States, as I said earlier, has got the best rule of law at home. And yet the United States has become one of the greatest violators of international law. I mean, conducting a war illegally in Iraq, as Kofi Annan said, and not ratifying treaties and conventions like the Law of the Sea Convention, virtually every other state had ratified. And this is something that Americans have got to wake up to and realize that this is no longer in America's national interest to do so, which is why I begin the book by quoting from a speech that President Bill Clinton gave in Yale in 2003, where he said, if America assumes it'll be number one forever, then fine. We should carry on doing what we're doing. It doesn't matter what the rest of the world thinks. But if we can conceive of the possibility that we'll no longer be number one, surely it's in America's interest to create a rules-based order that will constrain the next number one. He didn't mention names, but obviously he's talking about China. So if you want China to emerge as a law-abiding, rules-based superpower, then America should show the way. And America should lead the way by complying with international law.
If we are all converging, and if we are becoming a global community, how do we start to function as a global community? Which some people might not like, by the way.
The world, to use another metaphor, the one that Kofi Annan uses, is also becoming a global village. And if you live in a village, as you know, you must have a village council to mediate in disputes, to pick up the garbage, to ensure that the streetlights come on, and so on and so forth. In the same way, as we are becoming a global village, we need to also have stronger global village councils. If you start creating them from scratch, it's a mission impossible. It's almost impossible to start new organizations. But But the good news is that you have organizations like the United Nations, which were inspired by American ideals, produced by American statesmen, as you know, at the end of World War II. So the United Nations is essentially an American creation, which many Americans have forgotten. So why not try to strengthen and revive the United Nations and its sister organizations? If you live in a global village and if you're worried about a global pandemic, then what you should do right now is strengthen the World Health Organization. But sadly, it has been American national policy to weaken the United Nations and to weaken World Health Organization, to weaken the International Atomic Energy Agency. And what I say is that in this new world, it is time for the United States State Department to switch off its autopilot mechanism and review its old policies and now work on strengthening rather than weakening multilateral organizations.
And it sounds like to perhaps even stop dominating them.
The United States will always be powerful. Even if it becomes number two, it will remain one of the most powerful countries in the world. Given its sheer power, it will continue to dominate the world in one way or another. But what the United States can do now is to use its strength and its dominance to create a more cooperative world order, which will be more comfortable both for the United States and for other countries in the world. I'm not appealing to American idealism, to American altruism. I'm appealing to American self-interest to say, hey, it is now in your self-interest to strengthen these organizations.
There were a few aspects of these international organizations and the United States engagement that you pointed out. I think you call them barriers to convergence. The OECD, Afghanistan, the IMF, and the corrupt aid process. Perhaps you can give us a little thumbnail sketch of each of these and how you see them as barriers to this global community.
Yeah. One of the most ironic barriers to convergence is the belief in the West that the Western nations are the most generous nations in the world, and they believe they are the most generous because they give a lot of foreign aid to the rest of the world. And I think very few Americans know that even by OECD standards, America is one of the least generous nations among the OECD in terms of percentage of GNP that it gives out. And for every dollar that the United States gives out, 80 cents comes back to the United States and 20 cents goes to the recipient. So this is why I say, ironically, at a time when America is facing huge budgetary problems, many thoughtful, well-intentioned Americans may want to preserve America's foreign aid budget because they want to help the rest of the world. Actually, if America stops giving foreign aid, the world will not even notice it because it has very little impact on the rest of the world.
But some countries would notice it.
The two countries, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that receive the most amount of U.S. foreign aid are Israel and Egypt. And the rest of the world receives very little. And believe me, today, countries have finding other ways and means of developing. And much of American foreign aid, actually, and this has been documented by many authors, has a distorting effect on countries. And it actually doesn't help the country's development. So to use an old mantra, trade, not aid, is the answer.
You talked a bit about the geopolitical issues and some of the other clashes that are creating problems in our global village. One of them was the West and Islam. How do you see that being resolved?
Most people, when they read my book, think I'm a woolly-headed idealist. Actually, I've represented a very tough, realistic, pragmatic country like Singapore for 33 years. So I'm a hard-headed international realist. And I actually recognize that there are geopolitical challenges in the world that have to be overcome. But the good news I have is that they can all be overcome. And certainly in the case of Islam in the West, I see no necessary reason why there should be any kind of clash of civilizations, because most Muslim societies are modernizing and opening up themselves. I also suggest that there is a simple silver bullet that is available to reduce the tension between Islam and West, and that is, of course, a two-state solution between Israel and Palestine. It is in America's interest, in Israel's interest, in the interest of the Palestinians to work towards a two-state solution, and the best time to do it is now, and that will lead to also a reduction in tension between Islam and the West. The politics on this in America are very complicated.
We've been speaking with Kishore Mahbubani. His book is called The Great Convergence, Asia, the West, and the Logic of One World. Thank you so much. Next up, how does what we eat and what we experience get passed on to our offspring and their offspring? Stay tuned. Hi, Dunia. Yeah, Dunia, buddy, go. Hi, Dunia. इसमें कितने झोले गलियों गलियों चप्पा चप्पा अबलम चप्पलम लारे लप्पा तौबा तौबा रब्बा रब्बा जी 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 तोला पल में मासा पल में छोड़ा पल में फासा अगड़ में तिगड़ में देख तमाशा जी 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 आई दुनिया. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. For many years, geneticists and psychologists have worked in separate labs on the factors such as our genetic codes and our experiences that they each thought were affecting our physical and mental health, respectively. But it may be that our experiences are affecting our epigenetics, which can then get handed down for generations to come, contributing to diseases and behaviors such as cancer, diabetes, depression, and PTSD. How does all this work? Three experts join us. Eva Jablanka is a professor at Tel Aviv University and co-author of several books, including Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. Randy Jertl is a professor at Duke University and the University of Wisconsin and co-author of Environmental Epigenetics and Health and Disease, Epigenetics and Complex Diseases. Patrick McGowan also joins us. Patrick McGowan is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Toronto, studying epigenetic changes in the brain. Thank you so much for being with us. Eva Jablanka, let's start with you, particularly because of the title and subtitle of a book you co-authored, Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. You've looked at this as how we develop biologically, psychologically. How do you see these four dimensions fitting together and working together to determine our development?
So a human being is looking at itself and thinking about, why am I the way I am? Why do I have the traits that I have? Why do I behave the way that I do behave? What's making me tick? And then one begins to think, well, what are the inputs into my development? What kind of inputs are there? And we thought for a very long time that the most important input is the genetic input. The genes make you what you are. You are the way that you are because you have a particular genetic constitution. Now, there is no doubt that the particular genetic constitution that one has is one very important input into development. But of course, we know that the environment, too, is very important because it is the interaction between the environment and, as I shall elaborate, it's not only the environment in which one has been developing oneself, but also the environment of one's ancestors, that is very important, that this interaction with the genotype is what is, with the genes, is what makes us what we are. So what are the other inputs? So we were thinking, well, let's start with the, do we only get genes, DNA sequences from our parents? And of course we do get a lot more. We get also all kinds of epigenetic marks from our parents, which are carried in the egg and in the sperm. For example, all kinds of marks on the DNA, DNA methylation marks, some marks on the proteins around which the DNA is wrapped, are also transmitted with the egg and the sperm and affect our development. So we're getting all this epigenetic marks, these things that are above, epi is above the genome. So that's a second kind of development, a very important developmental input, which we're getting from our parents, and this epigenetic input depends depends on what happened to our parents, what genes were active in our parents, what genes were inactive, and the genes that were active or inactive, which genes were active and inactive, this depends on their own experiences, on their life, on what they went through. So this is the second dimension, the epigenetic dimension, which is a dimension of both heredity and development, because the interaction that we have with the world changes our epigenetics, and we also start with a particular epigenetic constitution in addition to the genetic constitution. So two things happens with us. Again, the first is that we get a particular genetic and epigenetic constitution from our parents, and the second is that this epigenotype is changing as we interact with the environment. It is dynamic. It is in flux. Now, the other thing that is important for development is what happens in the womb. We are mammals. And what happens in the womb may be very important for the way that we will develop. For example, the food that the mother eats, whether or not she was under psychological and nutritional stress, can make a difference to the development of her offspring. Sometimes it can even make a difference to the development of her grandchildren. But certainly, very often, it will make a difference to the development of her offspring. When we're thinking about early development, we are getting care and love and food and all kinds of other inputs from our parents. This early input has a very, very important effect on our development. And again, this can be not only about the development of us as the offspring of our parents, but also on our own children, the grandchildren of our parents. And then there is the symbolic dimension. This is a dimension that, you know, we all live in as human beings. This is, for example, language. We transmit a lot of information through language. We learn things through language, through symbolic systems. This is something which is very unique to humans, and there is no doubt that the culture, the symbolic culture in which we live, is something that constructs us, makes us into what we are. It is part of this totality. So we have the genetic system, the epigenetic system, the behavioral system, the things that make us behave, which are not dependent on symbols, that may be dependent, for example, on food preferences that we have, on the hormonal constitution that was affected by, for example, what our parents went through, and the symbolic dimensions. And all this together make us what we are. And they also not only make us what we are, they not only affect development, they can also affect heredity, the next generation. And because they can affect heredity, they can also affect evolution.
Let's bring Randy Jertle in now. This is kind of a perfect setup for some of the work you've been doing, particularly with passing on particular traits and characteristics by what the mother eats when she's pregnant. How does this affect the offspring and the offspring of the offspring?
Before I get into that, I came from an engineering background, so it's better for me to set up things in simple ways. I really think of the genome and the epigenome like being a computer and the programs that are running in that computer. So I think of the genome as being comparable to the hardware of a computer, and the epigenome, which is what we're talking about mainly today, is the software that tells that computer when, where, and how to work. Now, we got into this because we were studying the phenomena of genomic imprinting, and this is a phenomena where one copy of a gene is silenced epigenetically, usually through methylation and histone marks. It's shut down, so only one functional copy. And we wanted to determine really whether or not epigenetics played a role in what is called the fetal origins of adult disease susceptibility. And we did these studies really back in the beginning of around 2002, 2003. And this is when Rob Waterland was in my laboratory as a postdoc. And he wanted to look at this because he was a nutritionist and the effect of nutrition potentially have on the epigenome and then maybe potentially have on disease susceptibility. And to test this, we chose a very interesting model system. And that model system, when you're on radio, you can't see things as well, but I want the audience to think on the left-hand side, you have a beautiful yellow blonde animal that's obese, and on the right-hand side, you have a brown animal that's very, very thin. But these animals are genetically identical because they've been bred such that the genomes don't vary, but yet their characteristics are hugely different, not only the coat colors, but also their susceptibility to obesity, diabetes, and cancer. The blonde animals become obese, morbidly obese, and they get diabetes and cancer, whereas the brown animals are mean, lean, and clean all of their life. So what we did is we exposed the mother then to supplements in the diets, and these are supplements like folic acid, choline, betaine, vitamin B12. Why those compounds? Because those are the compounds that donate these little methyl groups, which is a carbon with three little hydrogens on it, that are then attached on directly onto the DNA. And we ask the question then, can we, when we do this, shift the distribution of the offspring by altering the mother's diet? And not only that, can we do that by altering the methylation patterns in a region that we knew was controlling this characteristic that we were seeing? And indeed, we showed that very clearly. So for the very first time, we had linked, basically, what the mother ate very early in life, right at these marks were placed in the embryo, probably right after fertilization. So we linked that very early time point in development with disease susceptibility in the offspring as adults through alterations in what we call the epigenome, or methylations in these histone marks, rather than changes in the genome. This then is the memory system, at least in this mouse system. This is the memory system that enables something that occurred literally right after fertilization to affect your disease susceptibility throughout your whole life.
Does that go on to the offspring of the offspring?
With this model system, it does, and that's been shown by other people. In other words, when it's passed through the mother, these marks are not taken off. So there's what's called a transgenerational inheritance of these epigenetic changes. And when it's passed at this one particular area of the genome, when it's passed to the father, the marks are taken off. So my point that I'm making is sometimes the marks aren't taken off efficiently, sometimes they are removed. But the important point is that there are many situations where these marks are not removed, so you have the potential then for a transgenerational inheritance of epigenetic phenomena that is being produced in response to the environment. So what we were studying was early developmental development, because that's when those marks are put down for differentiation and all the characteristics that we have. The genome in every cell, the DNA of the computer basically in the cell, is exactly the same. One copy from mom, one from dad. But yet we have 250 to 300 different cell types. And the reason we have that is because there's basically been developmentally programs established that tell one cell to be a liver cell, one to be a skin cell, one to be an eyeball cell, etc. So in effect, I really think of cells as being little mini programmable computers.
Patrick McGowan, you look at mental health issues, suicidal behavior, mood disorders, depression. How do you see these developing epigenetically?
Just to start, you know, to pick up from what Randy was saying, one of the things that fascinated me as a student in psychology, one of the classic debates was that of nature versus nurture, right? So how much of your behavior can be attributed to the genes that you carry from your ancestors, and how much can be attributed by the environment that you experience in life? And the way that epigenetics has come into the equation is to suggest that both of these things are intimately linked. And it's really difficult, and in some cases impossible, to separate them out. And we know that from studies of, for example, of identical twins, which are like what Dr. Gerald was talking about in terms of his identical mice, nature has provided us with examples in humans where we have two individuals that have exactly the same genome. And yet, in a lot of cases, in terms of mental health outcomes, like depression, for example, depression is something where if you see one twin with depression, there's maybe about a 50% chance that the other twin will show depression at some point in his life or her life. And so there's a significant contribution of things other than genetics. And it was always assumed that those things were differences in the environment the two twins experience. But it's become clear over the number of years that there's another layer of information on top of the genetic information, and that serves as kind of an interface between the environment and the genes, which is this epigenetic layer of information. And so what I've been studying is, my work has been focused more on stress and the role of changes in epigenetics in stress as a way to study some of the major antecedents of mental disorders like depression or anxiety disorder, for example, that where we know stress plays a major role. And in particular, in the early life environment, when during development, stress can have a major impact that lasts throughout the life of the person. And now we're coming to understand that that occurs in part, at least, through changes in the epigenetics of the individual rather than changes strictly in the environment, because the environment can change. The individual can go from being very poor early in life, for example, to being very rich, but some of those epigenetic marks from the early life stay with that person throughout their life.
So what you're essentially suggesting is perhaps it's not so much psychological mind. There is an actual physical component, which is probably what makes it difficult to change these things.
Yeah, absolutely. Something like depression, for example, is absolutely a physical disease. Depression doesn't just affect your behavior, but it affects all kinds of systems in the body, everything from your blood pressure, for example, the function of your liver. There's a variety of physical outcomes from depression that occur in part because what you're changing is you're changing all the a variety of hormones that are involved in response to stress. So from that standpoint, if we can understand how changes in something like the stress system can stay with us.
And then get passed on to the offspring.
And then potentially get passed on to the offspring. I mean, there's a fascinating area of research in post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, where at least anecdotally for a number of years it's been noted that the offspring of people who've experienced severe trauma, for example, Holocaust survivors, their offspring have a much different response to stress than the offspring of people who haven't had that in their history. And the question is how to explain that. Well, some of the answer perhaps is in epigenetic changes. And studies from animal models, for example, suggest that traumatic experiences might alter, for example, the information that the father passes on to its offspring through several generations as a result of that trauma through changes in these epigenetic marks. So with humans, it's very difficult to do these kinds of experiments. But at least the animal models are suggesting that some of the same kinds of processes could occur. And that might offer some great explanatory power and also some ways of changing the kinds of therapies that we use to remediate these effects.
Just a reminder that this is the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about how factors like our experiences, traumas, diets, and lifestyles get passed on to our offspring and their offspring. In essence, what we're saying is that the genes themselves are not necessarily the simple cause for these traits and illnesses. And it's not really just the environment either. It's this kind of dynamic that ultimately expresses itself physically. Eva Jablanka.
It's not the DNA sequence of the gene. It is the gene expression pattern. It is the activity of the gene. And the activity of the gene depends on this epigenetic mark, on the chromatin, on the way that the DNA is wound around the protein, in its methylation, all kinds of biochemical factors that make the chromatin, not the DNA sequence, but also other components of the cell, the components of the DNA and the bound proteins and the bound chemical groups, into an active or inactive gene. So it is not the DNA sequence of the gene, but it is the gene activity which is important. And what we thought for a very long time was that it is only the DNA sequence that is inherited from one generation to the next. The particular gene activity pattern is not inherited. It is reset every generation. And this is the change. We now realize that it is not always reset, that sometimes what happened in the past in previous generations can be inherited. So if you think the kind of analogy that Marian Lamb and I gave in our book, and that is if you think about the genome as the musical notes, and you think about the gene expression as the actual music played by players with the instruments and so on. So we thought that only the notes are inherited from one generation to the next. Now we know that we have another technology, like taping. Yes, the particular interpretation can be of a particular piece of music, if you want, can be passed on from one generation to the next.
Randy Jertl, what does this mean for treatment of these diseases like cancer or even obesity? Can the medical community now understand and figure out how to manipulate the epigenetics rather than killing off the particular tumor?
Before I answer that question, I just wanted to make, I think, an important point, too, is that the epigenome in its vulnerability varies with stage of development. So the most vulnerable time is when the epigenome is being established, which is really literally right after birth during that early first trimester. But it can be altered in adulthood, as been discussed previously. And the other problem is that when you get older, it's probable that your epigenome is not maintained as well. And one of the earliest changes that occurs, now I get to your answer of your question, is the earliest changes in cancer formation are epigenetic changes. And as a consequence, that destabilizes not only epigenome, but results in potentially more mutations, et cetera, which gives rise to tumors. And as a consequence, you know, you've got yourself a problem if you've got one of those. But if you actually think about the fact that it's not just genetically driven, but also potentially and is epigenetically driven, then your way in which your armamentarium in which you can actually treat tumors enhances, because you now have the potential of not just cytotoxically killing them with chemotherapeutic agents or with radiation or surgically removing them, but you also have the potential of developing compounds that alter the epigenome, because in cancer, for example, one way in which these tumor suppressors, which are brakes that inhibit cells from growing when they're inappropriately, often those tumor suppressors are mutated so they become non-functional. But another way that you can eliminate its function is by epigenetically silencing it so it no longer works, even though the gene is there. So you can now develop, and there are people have developed compounds that can be used now to open up these epigenetic marks and allow for those tumor suppressors which have been inappropriately silenced to be expressed. And often what happens then is it induces the cell to undergo what called programmed cell death, which is called apoptosis. So it's just another way in which you can potentially treat cancers. And I think it's going to be, in the future, a very, very powerful way to treat cancer. It's also potentially a way in which one can treat some developmental disorders, because there are a number of developmental disorders of which mind even and neurological problems and disorders, even maybe autism and schizophrenia, where you've got the dysregulation of these imprinted genes or a mutation in the only functional copy of the gene. Well, you have a normal copy. It's already there. So again, epigenetic therapy potentially could open up that silenced copy because it's perfectly fine. The other one's mutated, and then we have a problem, you know, a developmental problem, neurological issue, etc. But if you could open up that normal copy, you would now have epigenetic gene therapy, but you don't have to put the gene in there. It's already there. You just got it to get it to work. And people have already determined topoisomerase inhibitors, for example, are able to do this, at least in some of these neurological and developmental disorders. So it's a whole new field of therapy that's now just starting.
So what about then for some of these other disorders like depression, like PTSD, suicidal behavior, other mood problems? How is the therapy changing there? Patrick McGowan.
There's been an explosion in research in cancer biology in particular in terms of epigenetic drugs and drugs that change the epigenome. And people are starting to look at what are the effects of these drugs, if we use them in animal models, of some mental disorders, like depression, for example. And it turns out that some of these drugs do have the ability as either adjuvants to a standard therapy for depression, like an SSRI, for example, like a Prozac, or on their own can alter the epigenome and then also alter some of the symptoms of mental disorders. What we know, though, is that a lot of the time these drugs are what we call very dirty drugs. So they have very broad effects. And what we need to do is we need to figure out how to target these drugs to the right places in the genome, which is a big challenge, to be able to alter the epigenome of the genes that we want to alter and not affect broad-scale other kinds of genes. But there's been some fascinating research in neuroscience, for example, that's shown that some of these drugs, at least in animal studies, can reverse some of the effects of stress on the behaviors that we associate with anxiety and depression.
Patrick McGowan, you said something earlier that I'm a political scientist, changes how social science can think about phenomena like war, genocide. People who have experienced an extraordinary trauma like a genocide, genocide survivors, then passing on this epigenetic phenomena onto their offspring and their offspring, thereby kind of creating an overreaction to particular stimuli, environmental factors. Can we use these new studies to try to understand perhaps the causes of ongoing war and conflict? Do you think that there's a connection there?
One of the fascinating questions is in terms of how people become, for example, which people are resistant to the kinds of stresses that they experience during war and what makes them resistant to those kinds of stresses. I think part of the answer lies in epigenetics, because not everyone who experiences a suicide bomb, for example, gets post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a huge issue to try to understand this in returning vets in the U.S., for example, where we get a substantial proportion of people coming back that don't show maybe physical problems associated with their time in the war region. But then, you know, it turns out that they may have mental disorders that are associated with this. This is where I think it's necessary to view these as really a physical disorder, and mental disorders are just as much of a physical disorder as anything else. And it's a fascinating area to contemplate, to sort of think that we can start to try to understand at the level of physiology what's been changed in these individuals, or what makes them less resistant to the effects of stress in the battlefield than other people. You know, we're far ways from understanding that, but we have some clues.
Eva Jablonka.
So I just wanted to say something about your question. One of the things that for me are becoming clearer is that indeed things such as wars and chronic kind of stress, I'm living in a region which experiences this kind of stress, and malnutrition, which goes on for many generations, which again there are populations that are experiencing it. I think this kind of stresses have transgenerational effects, and I think that we have to study these things, that it is possible to study these things. It is possible to see how people who are living in this kind of condition, how their epigenome looks and what kind of effect it has on their behavior, on their temperament, on their ability to cope with stress, on their resilience to stress, because there may be also not only that things are just inherited in a simple kind of way, there may be also compensatory kind of changes in the epigenome of offspring. There are all kinds of possibilities. I think that it is enormously important to try and understand this kind of things, because otherwise we will not be able to cope intelligently with the effects of the stresses and the effects of the social, political stresses. And so I think that we can talk about, in a way, about the biology of culture and the culture of biology.
Randy Jertle?
Yeah, I just have one comment that I'd like to make. I use animal models all the time, but I want to make a point that's very, very, I think, very, extremely important. Though animal models can be incredibly important in finding how things work, et cetera, and mechanisms and stuff. I want to make it very clear that the epigenomes vary greatly between species, probably more so maybe than even the genomes do. And as a consequence, what does this mean? It means that ultimately we've got to find those genes that are most susceptible or epigenetically labile within the species that we are, at least I seem to be most interested in, which are humans. And that means that a lot of studies, epidemiological studies, and epigenetic studies have to be done ultimately in human populations. It's more difficult to do this, but one doesn't have the problem of extrapolation because you're dealing with the species that we're obviously most interested in. And I'm not saying that other species are not important, but from the standpoint of diseases and stuff, that's what we're interested in.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you sharing your research and your thoughts with us and with our listeners. Eva Jablonka is a professor at Tel Aviv University and co-author of several books, including Evolution in Four Dimensions, Genetic, Epigenetic, Behavioral, and Symbolic Variation in the History of Life. Randy Jertle is a professor at Duke University and the University of Wisconsin and co-author of Environmental Epigenetics and Health and Disease, Epigenetics and Complex Diseases. Patrick McGowan is a professor of neuroscience at the University of Toronto, studying epigenetic changes in the brain. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipranankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.